Well, thank you very much for the really warm welcome we've had this morning. It's great to be with you, and we're looking forward to telling you about our story. Shortly after our accident, which was in 2008, we celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary. So more recently, we celebrated our 45th anniversary. So 15 years that we almost never had. And also, after our accident, we spent many hours together in hospitals and in doctors' waiting rooms, doing physical therapy exercises in the gym and recovering at home. And we found that actually we're still best friends. And from my perspective, there's no one else on the planet that I would rather spend my time with. And we're so grateful that we both survived and that we still have each other. But you're probably asking, well, I heard you talk to the youngsters about a road accident, but what did happen to these two people? Which we'll tell you. But more importantly, what can we learn from it that's of value to all of us? And this is where it matters to you. Well, in order to do that, I need to talk a little bit about motorcycling. I've always loved motorbikes. I was on a motorcycle on my 16th birthday, and that's the earliest you can legally ride in the UK. And I've owned and ridden machines of various sizes over the years. One of my lifelong ambitions was always to ride motorcycle road trips in the USA. And then in 2007, I got my chance when my employer offered me a 3-year work assignment based in Houston, Texas. So at the end of 2007, the two of us relocated from leafy Surrey to concrete and glass Houston for this 3-year assignment. And a few months after we arrived, it was the 16th of May 2008, we were exploring our new surroundings on a motorcycle. We were exploring down the southwest coast of Houston towards the Mexico border and the Rio Grande. This is the machine that we crashed. It was a 2008 Harley-Davidson FLHR Road King, 96 cubic inch V-twin air-cooled engine. I'm picking up messages that maybe not everyone in the room is as keen on motorcycles as I am. So, Chris, stop talking about the bike, otherwise we'll be here all morning. Enough to say it was just a marvellous touring machine. This photo was actually taken the evening before our accident and we were living the dream. The next day, we were on our road trip and it was 2:30 in the afternoon and we were on Highway 35. Which is a county road down towards the city of Corpus Christi. It's Highway 35 at that point is a typical Gulf Coast road, dead straight, dead flat, a two-laner, so one lane of traffic going in each direction, and a 70-mile-an-hour speed limit. It was a lovely day. It was springtime, clear blue sky, dry roads, light traffic on a weekday afternoon, and bam, suddenly everything changed. We don't have any recollection of what happened, but there was a reconstruction about a year later in a small town Texas courtroom, and it went something like this. I was riding the Road King at 55 miles an hour. It was a 70 mile an hour speed limit. Denise was on the pillion. A young driver in a Ford F-150 truck comes up behind us, and 55 is not quite fast enough for him, so he overtakes safely to our left. You remember we're on the right-hand side of the road in the States. So he's completed his overtaking maneuver, and now I'm looking at the back of a Ford truck, a big Ford truck. The truck driver notices that there's a red vehicle coming at him at high speed on the wrong side of the road. So he's thinking, is he asleep at the wheel? Is he on the phone? Is he going to get back in his own lane? No, he's not. So at the last moment, the truck driver drives off the road. Now I can see the red vehicle, which is coming at me at over 80 miles an hour. I'm doing 55, so we've got a combined closing speed of over 135 miles an hour. Things are happening at 60 meters a second. It's no time to react, and he hit us head on. The next vehicle in line behind us was another truck, a white Chevrolet, a driver with his wife on board. They see the impact, this explosion of motorcycle parts, two bodies flying through the air like rag dolls. The white truck driver hits the brakes to slow down and stop for the accident. The red vehicle goes back on the correct side of the road, but then comes over and hits the white truck, almost kills the driver and severely injures his wife. This is the red vehicle that hit us. You can see that it caught fire. They pulled the driver from the wreckage. He was badly injured, but he survived. And you can see the orange spray paint on the grass, which is because the police thought that there was going to be a fatal accident inquiry. This is the white truck that was behind us. Now, remember, he was slowing down to stop for the accident before he was struck. But even so, that fence on the right-hand side is about 20 meters off the road. That's how far he was bounced by the impact. You can see in the distance there's a couple of figures standing over what was left of the motorcycle. We'd been taken away by that point. Here is what was left of the Road King, with our belongings scattered around it. Again, you can see the orange paint on the grass. This is the good side of the bike. This is the other side, when they took it away to the breaker's yard. If you know anything about motorcycles, well, even if you don't, you might notice that the left fork holding the front wheel isn't there anymore. There's no pannier or exhaust pipe on the left-hand side anymore. The crash bar is bent back against the engine. And of course, that's the side of the bike where our left legs were. It turned out that the driver of the red vehicle was over three times the drink drive limit at 2:30 in the afternoon on a weekday. The limit in Texas is the same as it is over here, which is 80 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. So the limit is 80, and he was at 250, which is the equivalent of 2.5 to 3 bottles of wine, or in his case, over half a liter of whiskey. For further context, the limit is 80, he was at 250. 350 is the equivalent of a general anaesthetic in hospital. Now, at this point, I left planet Earth to go and live somewhere else for quite some time. So I'll let Denise take up the story.
Right, you're going to have to forgive me if I just imagine that you are a room full of 6 and 7 year olds. And as a teacher, then I'll relax. The truck driver said that Chris would have had less than half a second to react. We're both terribly injured, as you can imagine. We were taken actually in his and hers helicopters to the nearest trauma hospital at Corpus Christi. We both had severely crushed left legs. Mine had to be amputated straight away. We both had broken left arms and hands. My arm was what they called degloved because I lost a lot of skin. We landed on our heads, so we both had concussion. Chris's was a lot worse than mine. And because poor Chris was at the front of the bike, he got the internal injuries. So he got punctured lung, broken ribs, ruptured spleen. So Chris was in intensive care unit for over 2 weeks, most of that time in a medically induced coma. I got out of intensive care in less than a week. But, of course, I came round in a hospital bed and I'm now looking down at flat bedclothes where my left leg should be. I've got a huge, heavy plaster cast on my left arm. I can't move. I'm in a lot of pain. I know Chris is more seriously injured, I just don't know how badly. And we often describe those early days to people as, you know, having a nightmare that you wake up to instead of a nightmare that you wake up from. Next few pictures, word of warning, just a bit more graphic. This is Chris, 2 days after the crash, in the medically induced coma. He's fighting for his life. You can see the blue tubes of the ventilator. He's still got his left leg at this stage. They've got it in traction, metal bar around it. And you can see a gentleman standing over the bed. That's our American pastor, Pastor Frankie. After 10 days, the leg was killing Chris. So our eldest son and I signed for his amputation. Well, that night, I hardly slept. I mean, I was worrying, praying, trying to leave it with the Lord. But you know what it's like? You take it back and you worry and you pray. Would Chris make it through the operation? Because he was so weak. And if he did make it, would he agree with the decision that we'd now taken for him? But the amputation marked the start of his recovery. As soon as Chris's employer heard the news, they cleared for our three youngsters to fly out to the States. We got two sons and a daughter. At the time, Ben was 25, Tom was 22, Miriam was 18 and in her first year at university. Now, they embarked on a 10-hour flight, not knowing how many parents they were going to have when they arrived in Houston. Chris's company were utterly amazing. I mean, they organized and paid for hotel, hire car, mobile phone, even gave our youngsters spending money and said, just stay until your parents are out of danger. After a month, we were well enough to move to a rehabilitation hospital in Houston. So here we did lots of therapy. You can see we're sharing an exercise table. They've strapped weights to our good leg. You do lots and lots of lifting exercises because that leg's got to be really strong for when you start walking with a prosthetic. We both had further arm surgery, but we were both home 2.5 months after the crash. This is poor Chris when he got home. His weight had fallen to less than 53 kilograms. That's less, if you're old school like me, that's less than 8.5 stone. You can see the scar up his abdomen. That's where they took the spleen. And he assures me there were 54 metal staples in there because he counted them when they took them out. See the white bandage on his right leg? That's covering the donor site. That's where they took skin to patch his stump. Now, my donor site had to be bigger, of course, because I needed a skin graft on my stump, but also my arm. Much happier slide now. Both home, in wheelchairs, smiling. You can see how red my forearm is. That's the new skin graft, but it took really well. And Chris has had an operation on his fingers and his left elbow. We continue with outpatient therapy. 4-month mark, really exciting. We got our first prosthetic legs. But it's hard to keep them on all day. And then you've got to learn to walk again. When Chris could walk 50 meters with a stick, the company doctor said, you can come back to work part-time. Outpatient therapy lasted till the 9-month mark, and then we decided to do a further year of chiropractic therapy because, as you know, we landed on our heads, so we damaged our spines.
So that's a summary of what happened to us, but as I said earlier, probably of more importance, this is where it matters to you, is what can we learn from it that's of value as we try and all live our lives? And we think we've got a number of things to say. The first thing we would say is that miracles still happen. We had an email a few months after the crash from one of the state troopers who attended the accident scene. Experienced policeman, he'd seen a lot of road traffic accidents, a lot of injuries. And he wrote that he'd seen our injuries and then later on he heard that we survived. And he wrote, I can hardly believe it, it's a miracle. And in our case, a large part of the miracle was the speed of the first responders. There was an emergency call. Police were there within 15 minutes, and they joined volunteer fire crew who were already working there. 2 ambulances were scrambled from a nearby hospital. Remember, this is a remote rural area. And they arrived within 24 minutes, fully crewed with paramedics, and in less than an hour we were on those 2 life flight helicopters to the nearest trauma hospital, which was only 60 miles away, which is not that far by helicopter. First responders often talk about the golden hour. If things happen well in the first hour after an incident, then the chances of survival and recovery are dramatically different. And in our case, the golden hour ran on rails. So that's our first point. Miracles still happen. Watch out for them. The next thing we would say is an obvious one, and that is that cars, motor vehicles, are potentially lethal weapons. Our roads here in the UK are amongst the safest roads in the world. They're about twice as safe as the roads in Texas per mile travelled, and they drive a lot of miles in Texas. But even so, here in the UK, we have about 1,800 road deaths each year, which averages 5 a day. So that's 5 people killed on our roads every day of the year, which is a statistic we're often unaware of, probably because road accidents don't sell newspapers. But we become aware of it if it happens to somebody who's close to us. So, of course, our message to you is that when we're behind the wheel of these lethal weapons, it requires our full attention, no distractions. Another thing we would say, and we hope that we're much better at this since our crash, is how important it is to intervene if you see something crazy happening. Our drunk driver was trying to drive home after having been on a fishing trip. So he'd been on a boat all morning with other people who'd seen him drinking heavily. They will have seen him arrive back at the dockside, inebriated, trying to get into his car, trying to drive home. We heard in the courtroom how witnesses had seen him driving erratically for several miles on Highway 35. And yeah, he's on the wrong side of the road, and oh, he's back on the right side. He's speeding right up, and he's really going slowly. Now he's speeding up again. He's on the wrong side of the road again. Here comes an 18-wheeler. Is he going to make it? Oh, he's just about made it back. Somebody's going to get killed or seriously injured here. So all of this, and nobody did anything. Nobody made a phone call. Nobody raised the alarm. Nobody stopped him, which left us thinking, why is this so difficult? Well, we think the answer is actually found in the Bible. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 25 says, "Fear of man will prove to be a trap." And it's true. We see something daft happening, and we feel that we should say something about it, but we're frightened, fear of man. We're frightened of what people might think or say or do. So it's easier for us to keep our opinions to ourselves. And most of the time, we get lucky. Situation resolves, nobody gets hurt. But if we carry on not intervening, eventually there will be an accident. So our message is, if you see something crazy happening, and we hope we're better at this now, be the one to say, is this a good idea? Have you thought this through? It doesn't need to be rude. If it's somebody talking on the phone while they're driving or trying to climb an unsecured ladder, be that brave person and you may save a life. There are two reasons for showing this next photo. We're quite happy to take questions at the end. The first reason for showing this photo is that I like to brag. I was a marathon runner before the accident. This was the Austin Half Marathon in Texas just a few weeks before the crash, and I took an age group 5th place. But the other reason for showing the photo is to underline that being physically fit can not only give you life, I loved running, but it can also save your life. I was training and racing about 35 miles a week right up to the accident. Denise was slim and fit, and still is, exercising every morning and walking regularly with friends. And the medics, both in the trauma hospital and in the rehab hospital, said that our survival and our rapid rate of recovery was a direct result of the fact that we were in good nick physically before the accident happened. Well, I have to be careful here because endurance sports is not everyone's cup of tea. I quite understand that. But it is worth thinking about that a basic level of physical fitness can make all the difference when bad things happen, because fit people are harder to kill.
We also discovered that things are much better if you've got a good support structure, good friends around you, and like you've got here, you know, a good church family, a caring church family. As news broke, 4 to 5 carloads of the US church were travelling down to Corpus Christi to visit us. The UK church, they arranged flights for our youngsters and drove them to the airport. Now, very surprising, our next door neighbours dropped everything, picked up our 3 and drove them to Corpus Christi. That is a 4-hour drive, and then they stayed overnight. The pastor that you saw in that earlier photo, he came every week. He made 4 trips in all. I got out of hospital eventually before Chris, but I was walking with a next-door neighbour and her best friend, who was an ex-nurse. She said, "Don't worry, I'll come and stay with you." So she stayed with me for 2 weeks before Chris got out of hospital. The neighbours, friends and church, they had a sort of Help the Arthi project. So they produced this amazing rota. They brought meals every night. They arranged transport to and from hospital appointments, doctor's appointments. There was even a rota for housework. But we had to change the meal rota. This was Texas. The meals were enormous. This gentleman in the church, he was a building contractor, and he also said, "Don't worry." And he did all the modifications to the house. So he built a wheelchair ramp up to the front door, widened the family bathroom doorway, and put up support rails. The church paid for all the materials, and Doug offered his labour free of charge. We had lots of prayer in the UK and the US. I can only tell you it was tangible. It was like being lifted. We knew people were praying for us. It was like being lifted and carried above the circumstances. We had lots of flowers and lots of encouraging cards. And I'm just going to read a little bit, very small bit. During this time, God provided a revelation of truth and hope from an unexpected source. A large brown envelope arrives in my ward. Inside are letters from the year 2 children, the 6 and 7-year-olds, back in England. There's also a card from the classroom teacher I'd worked with for years. I am overwhelmed by the sentiments they express. A little girl in this class has written, "Dear Mrs. Arthi, I was so sad to hear about your bad crash. I hope you don't have another one." Direct and to the point as only a child can be, even in my present state, the words make me laugh. I know what she means. Later, a friend brings another large envelope. This one is full of cards from the kindergarten class in the US, where I've been working as a volunteer. Each card is very similar. In my mind's eye, I can just see the words written on the board at the front of the class for the children to copy. "We miss you. Get better soon." The cards are covered in a bright assortment of stickers and patterns. One card stands out. It's from a little girl I remember well. And inside it, quite independently, she has written, "Do you see a rainbow?" And on the back is a beautifully coloured rainbow. How do children always get to the heart of the matter? A lump forms in my throat and my spirit jumps.
Another thing that we've learned is that we can't expect to understand everything. This is the why me question. Why me? Why us? And I like to think I was a careful motorcyclist. I'd never crashed a machine before in my life. I've been on these safe rider courses with the British Motorcycle Police, so I'd done all that. I've never had a speeding ticket in my life, either on a motorcycle or in a car. I did get a parking ticket once, a number of years ago, but we were on our honeymoon and I think I must have been distracted. And this was a well-planned trip, and we had the right gear on. We had crash helmets, we had eye shields, leather gloves, leather jackets, stout boots. We weren't in any hurry, 55 in a 70-mile-an-hour limit. We were stopping regularly for coffee breaks to make sure we didn't get tired. And why, in all of the tens of thousands of miles I've ridden on motorcycles, why would this happen on the rare occasion when I have my precious wife on the pillion? Well, I have this list. It's the list of things that Chris does not understand. And this why me, why us question is right up there at the top of the list. And when it's my turn to go to the pearly gates, I'm taking that list with me because I want some answers. I have a feeling that when I get there, I'll toss the list away because then it won't matter anymore. We all know that 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12 scripture. Yeah, now we see but a poor reflection, then we shall see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I shall know fully, even as I'm fully known. Which is a great scripture. But for now, that list is really important to me because it reminds me that we really can't expect to understand everything.
So some things we learned we had to just let go of. Other things, though, were within our control. And we learned the importance of perseverance, especially with therapy. After the surgery to our hands and arms, we had to work really hard at getting full range of motion back. It was particularly painful and often really discouraging. These things look like something out of Star Wars. They're Dyna splints. We used to wear them three times a day, half an hour each time. And they're designed to stretch your hand in a rotated position. Now, we have very little movement. They also used to say to us, make a fist, and that's all we could do. And it used to take 10 minutes with the other hand to force one finger down onto the palm. Now, something you should know about is we are highly, highly competitive. So we would sit at home after therapy, doing our homework, watching a film. And the film used to be interspersed with, I've got two fingers down. I added up all the exercises that we were doing each day. And that included outpatient therapy and at home for homework. It came to up to 4 hours. And we had to eat and we had to sleep. And we did a lot of sleeping. But you have to stick at therapy, even if it feels hopeless. And I think it's just like the Christian walk. Sometimes we just need the encouragement of the faith of others. So we decided we were just going to put our faith in the faith of the therapists. And we got it all back, absolutely everything. Amazing.
You probably realise that if you have an accident like ours, all sense of dignity departs, and it really helps to have a sense of humour. And to illustrate that, this is the gear I had to wear when they made the casting for the socket on my first prosthetic leg. You can see by the look on Denise's face that she's very amused by these high fashion items that I'm wearing. But half an hour later, it was Denise's turn to wear similar high fashion items. Denise is very pleased I don't have a photo of that. But I do have this photo. This one was taken just a few seconds after Denise stood up out of the wheelchair for the first time on her new prosthetic leg. What was that like?
Do you know, it's really hard to put into words what an emotional moment that was. It caught me by surprise. After months in a wheelchair, to be standing upright again on two legs, it was just incredible.
We've also found how important it is to have a hope and a future, to know why it is that you're here on earth. This is the two of us walking back into church for the first time on our new prosthetic legs. Now, Denise is using a walking frame, I've got a walking stick, but we are walking independently back into church, and that was a great day.
I'm going to interrupt, Chris, because you wouldn't believe the song that the worship team chose that morning. I'm still standing.
Our theme tune has become Psalm 124, which is the psalm that says, if the Lord had not been on our side, then things would have overwhelmed us. But because he's on our side, it's as if the net has been broken and we've escaped. Like a bird out of the fowler's snare, the snare has been broken and we're free. We could have died in the accident. We nearly did. But for us, that would have been fine. As I said, we don't remember the accident. There would have been no pain. We know where we're going, and we would have been straight there. people would have said nice things about us. We were a popular couple. They would have put flowers on our graves. All good. But it would have been awful for our youngsters. And what about the assignment on our lives? We believe that we're still here because the assignment on our lives isn't finished yet. It may not be what we originally had in mind. It may be something a little bit different now, probably on the lines of what we're doing this morning, and that is the two of us working together, talking to people, trying to explain that even if really bad things happen, you don't have to be under the circumstances, but you can rise above them, and how that's possible.
If you'd told us beforehand what was going to happen, well, I don't think I would have got on the plane. But we would have said to you that we wouldn't have thought our faith would have coped. But honestly, from the moment that we surfaced in hospital, you know, God's presence was so alive in that room. And it was like everything was stripped away, but the Lord remained. And it's just like he promised. He never let us go. I can remember Chris coming up to my ward. I was on the top floor of the hospital in his wheelchair, got tears streaming down his face. And he looked down and waved his good arm over his body. And he said, you know, this just reminds me that Jesus's body was broken for us. And it wasn't just that Jesus was with us. It really came home to us that, you know, because he'd suffered, he understood and he knew exactly what we were going through, the pain and the suffering. And that was just so comforting. The other thing that happened was scriptures would just pop into my mind. I mean, things that I didn't even know I knew. One in particular was Romans 8:28. You know, all things work together for good for those who love God and accord according to his purposes. And I just clung on to that one with white knuckles. And I decided I was going to write it down. So I wrote it down, gave it to Frankie, the pastor, and I said, will you please read this over Chris in the coma? Will you pin it up in his ward? Because somehow I wanted that declared over him while he was recovering. And all things have worked together for good. For a number of years, the first thing we would see when we woke up in the morning was the wheelchair beside the bed. It's the first choice of the day. You get up, get in the wheelchair, start moving around. So each day was just a series of choices. And we soon discovered that if you put enough good choices together in a row, you get a good day. Enough good days together in a row, you get a good week. If you carry on like that, you can build a good life again. Now, another really important choice facing us was that of forgiveness. After the sentencing trial, which was a year after the crash, the drunk driver asked the judge if he could come across the courtroom to speak to us, which he did. And he got tears in his eyes and he said, look, I can't give you your legs back. I'm so terribly sorry for what I did to you. Can you possibly ever forgive me? Now, we'd searched our hearts and surprisingly, we never felt any bitterness towards him. And that helped us put all our energy into recovering. You know, we had enough on our plates to go down the bitterness, hatred route. It would have only hurt us. So we said to him, yes, we forgave you when we were in hospital. We also decided to keep in touch with him. I'll tell you what he got. He got a short prison sentence, 4 months, followed by 10 years of probation. And as far as we're aware, he never lost his driving license. Well, that was a shock. Anyway, we visited him when he was in the county jail. We exchanged emails probably every 6 months over the years. At the end of 2012, when we left America, he asked to see us again, so we had lunch with him and his wife. And we were able to reassure him that as far as we were concerned, he was forgiven. In 2019, he wrote an amazing email to us, thanking us for our kindness and our support, because he said it helped him cope emotionally over the years. In 2022, we went back to Texas again, had a meal with him and his wife, and they were great company. But right at the end of the meal, he surprised us. He said, well, when you're next in Texas, please come and stay with us at our house. We are still discovering the remarkable power of forgiveness. I mean, it freed us up, it freed him up.
They say that on a scale of difficulty from 1 to 10, today's problems are always a 10. So how difficult is it for us living life with one leg each? Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 10. But we're quite aware that we're not the only ones who are facing difficulties in life. We're not going to do this, but I'm sure if I went round the room and asked what's bothering you, we would find that there are people here who are suffering from physical health problems, mental health problems, worries about relationships, finances, addictions. So whatever it is you're facing, on a scale of 1 to 10, that's a 10. Jesus himself said in John chapter 16, verse 33, in this world you will have trouble. You can expect it. On a scale of 1 to 10, there will be 10s. But then he goes on to say, but take heart, I've overcome the world. That's not quite the end of our story. As you heard earlier, a year and a half after the accident, I took delivery of my first running leg. Now, at first, it was really painful, and I could only run a few yards before I was completely puffed out, and I fell over a lot, which wasn't fun. But I signed up straight away for my first 5 kilometre race as an amputee against a field of able-bodied competitors. And a few weeks later, after a number of painful training sessions, I completed that first 3-mile race. I didn't run the whole way because I was still getting my fitness back, but I finished in less than 50 minutes. I didn't fall over and I didn't come last. And that was the beginning of a long return to endurance sports. So in this configuration, I've now run 2 full marathons. This is the cycling leg I was telling you about. It's got a freewheeling hinge for a knee, so it doesn't offer any resistance, and it clips onto the pedal on the left. So the chap on the left is basically getting a free ride, while the chap on the right is doing all the hard work. So I learnt to cycle again. I learnt to swim again. I found quite quickly that I can swim breaststroke, but every time I kick, I turn left. So I stick to freestyle because then I can swim in a straight line. It's much more effective. So with the swimming, the cycling and the running, of course, I do triathlons. I've competed 4 times in the British Para Triathlon Championships, and I'm currently training for this year's National Championships, which will be at Eaton Dorney in August. And while we were in Texas a couple of years ago, I did a half Ironman, which was another daft idea. That was a 1.2-mile open water swim, then 56 miles on the bike, and then a 13.1-mile half marathon, which took me all day. I'm not as fast as I used to be, but I'm not as young as I used to be either. In 2016, as a 60th birthday and retirement present, I had a go at Mount Kilimanjaro with our second son, Tom. You can probably work out in the picture which one I am. Our son, Tom, is the one third in line with the pink rag on his head. And this was just after the steepest part of the climb. And later in the trek, here we are at the summit. This was the highest point in Africa, just under 6,000 metres. The photo was taken at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was -5 centigrade, so all the water in our packs had frozen solid. And there was only half the oxygen that we're enjoying here in Stirling this morning. So we took a couple of quick photographs and we went downstairs to where the air was easier to breathe. I still can't believe we got away with that. It's another one of those miracles I was telling you about earlier. And then in 2019, I was off adventuring again. This was a trek to Everest Base Camp. The mountain in the picture is not actually Everest, it's Amadablam, another beautiful Himalayan peak. And we were walking past that for several days, and I think it became my favorite. And 2 years ago, our book was published, Highway 35, Meeting Disaster Head-On with Hope. And we've got plenty of copies at the back, cash or card. We wrote the book because, and we do this speaking, because we realized that life doesn't always go to plan. I mean, there are bumps in the road. Some of them are worse than others, and some of them are a lot worse than ours. But whatever you're facing, it's our prayer that Highway 35 would help you to meet disaster head on with hope.
So in summary, we'd say yes, we can see that rainbow that the little girl drew on her card, because every day for us now is a gift. So thank you for listening. We're going to show a really short video, and then if there's time, open it up for questions. Now, we do mean any questions. We've spoken to lots of audiences, including children. And I can remember being in a class of 6 and 7 year olds when one bright spark puts his hand up at the back of the class and says, "So, how did they get the leg off?" I've never seen a teacher pale so quickly. "And when they got it off, what did they do with it? Is it in a grave somewhere?" So I don't think you can shock us with the questions.